puzzling about your life,
yes,
is that
a range of cushions, if you like. Well, I never know anything about cushions.
That's splendid.
That's
lovely.
Cool.
What I find puzzling is that your life's got two halves to it which don't seem to fit together.
Yes, they have nothing to do with each other.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. I mean, because you said you were in the women's movement earlier, didn't you? That is, before you went to China.
No, there wasn't a movement.
I see. I mean,
before we went to China, which was in 21, 22, there was a war which was a blank. And nothing happened then. 1914, I had only just qualified.
I see. So you weren't, you were a supporter of women's suffrage, I suppose, were you? But
a very faint-hearted supporting one. I met a lot of them, but I'm not a militarist.
Yes.
It's a rather curious combination. That I'm a passionate propagandist, but no partisan.
Yes, I quite understand.
I won't join any kind of a movement that's doing things that I don't approve of. So, from their point of view, I didn't exist. It was only a mental sympathy.
You were never connected with the National Union of
Society. No, I refused to join them.
Yes,
but I knew a lot of them.
Did you? Yes.
Because among my 13 companions as fellow students, there was nobody really very passionate, but a few of the younger staff were, I think, encoiled in a way in admiration of Mrs. Pankhurst. But I couldn't do with that. When she was in prison, you remember, she was doing all that, a lot of them used to walk around the prison all night.
You mean to wear themselves out, you mean?
Schoolgirls, sentimentality.
Yes.
Because I have absolutely no sympathy with it at all.
Could you just remind me where you were trained, Dr. Wright? Where you were trained?
Royal Free Hospital.
I see.
Oh, you better get that down.
I rather like that, yes.
Then we start with the School of Medicine in 1910. Did we do nothing of that?
Nothing of that at all, you see. It'd be rather nice. Mm.
Yes, well, that ought to be the introduction. Because it was the means by which the two halves of the life could be implemented. Without that, there was nothing. But I don't see how it'll be much use to you. Because now I should like to know a little more from you. Where do you see the limits of your theme?
Well,
now, are you doing a PhD?
I've done my PhD.
Purely on your own.
Yes, let me just switch this off. But I mean, I hope that explains what I mean. Your point is that once you've got no enemies to fight, the movement, in a sense, goes into the ground.
Well, it doesn't exactly go into the ground, but I think it becomes disappointed with itself.
I see.
Because before, when there was a distance, what I heard from them, they were hoping that once women got into Parliament, once the millions of women in the country got the vote, there would be a marked change in politics.
Mm.
Well, there wasn't.
No, I agree.
And it was awfully hard for the leaders to realise, I think perhaps for the first time, how impossible it is to do anything good in politics.
Mm. Mm. But you see, I wondered whether one line of continuity in your life, you see, was between a certain sympathy with suffragism or feminism later,
no.
You see. So that won't work.
The two lines of mine were quite distinct and entirely personal.
Yes.
China and medicine.
Mm.
And then the birth control movement and medicine.
Yes.
There was no link between them at all.
It was
purely accidental that they had to be so broken up. And the Japanese were responsible for that.
But, I mean, you see, another line of continuity might be that you became aware in China of the importance of the population problem, generally, with won't work either.
No, you can't say that, because it didn't exist.
Yes.
In China, it was the opposite. as I think I told you, that the infant mortality was then at such a height that it would be pure cruelty to have suggested anything of the sort at all. What they wanted was infant life, and happier and more well looked after pregnancies. So their children should live.
I understand, yes. So when you
see, that's nothing to do with England at all.
So when you get back to England, is it literally pure chance then that you get involved in the birth control movement?
No, that wasn't.
You had nothing to do.
No, that was a kind of crypto logic which had had the 5 years sleep. And you can say in a way that began to be conscious when I first read Mary Stuart's first book.
Yes.
Which is perfectly logical.
Before you went to China?
While I was still a student. That personality, Mary Stuart's, had revealed a different evil, you say, or a sorrow or a tragedy, any one of those negative words, which was happening in the population, of which she was the only person to reveal it. And that was obviously of such importance that it sank deep in. And then its next help was when we met, as I told you, in Cornwall in late 1918, and actually talked the whole thing over. Then that had to go underground for 5 years while we were in China. But it made no difference, because when we came back, it was there. And how much psychology do you know?
None, really. So.
This could be rather interesting for you to find out, not to find out, but to observe, because you can't really find out, you observe in a very strongly marked personality how the things that are going to be powerful are there in embryo, but they're unable to come out and manifest themselves until the other circumstances give them a field. Mm. Now, does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So you wouldn't say that while you were in China you were bursting to get on with birth control when you got back to England at all?
Quite the contrary. When we were in China, we were both of us. My husband was a surgeon, and his work was perfectly straightforward. He had to do the best thing he could for all his surgical patients. It wasn't allied. I had only women patients. Therefore, my interests were to do what I could for the miseries that happened to be in China, which had no relation with England.
Yes, yes.
So although all the underneath was there, it was fast asleep.
I understand. That's fine. That's all set up.
There's far too much to do in the opposite direction.
Hmm. Well, about the world population movement, so to speak, the IPPF that's become so important now, how important was that in the 1930s? I mean, stopping
at
the Second
World
War.
Not at all. Now, that's what I want to see if I can somehow work into your thesis. What made you choose 1940?
Well, purely arbitrary reason. I mean, simply that I've got to stop somewhere in studying the women's movement in general. And as you know, the WVS starts up in the late 30s, and a number of different organisations appear, and so on. No other reason than that, really. Do you think I should stop somewhere else?
Well, it depends.
For the birth
on
control
the
movement, I should.
Of your view.
Yes.
And from my point of view, having worked always with the biggest possible point of view, I found it very difficult to respect time limits which are purely artificial.
I understand, yes. It's just a question of time, really.
Yes,
no other reason.
Because what you're going to say will have to stop abruptly.
Yes.
And I would like to say another thing also about the general public. What's going to happen to your paper?
Oh, well, it makes you say that.
Now, this is going to take a bit of time, because the conception of the whole idea grew very slowly. And I think it will be quickest if I tell you of the facts. effects first.
Do, yes.
And then we can examine the effects.
Yes.
And understand what happened because of the effects. If
right.
You can see that it is really a logical
yes,
method.
Yes, of course, yes.
Now, first, these are on, are they?
Yes, they are now, yes.
Now, we're talking about history, which is very spotty, because that's how it happened. The movement in England, I have told you about, and I had intimate connection with from the very beginning, was actually a pioneer. And between 1930 and 1948, that's 18 years. So 1940 means nothing to me. 1948, we were working as hard as we could and very successfully, on the whole, in England to get the idea rooted and implemented that women, parents, let's say, don't put too much emphasis on women, parents had a natural right to have the children they wished and could deal with. And very gradually that simple idea became clearer and clearer. Now in the meantime, other countries were having similar ideas, but working them out differently. And it was a matter of chance, to some extent, of which of us in England came in contact with them. Now we have to go back, quite surprisingly, to 1930 again, when Margaret Sanger, now what do you know about her?
Well, only that she's the great American pioneer,
yes.
Really.
Now Margaret Sanger was truly a great person in her way. She alone, in the huge country of America, started, she was a trained nurse, not a doctor, but of course had a medical background. She started a campaign for exactly the same thing, that women shouldn't be condemned to become pregnant when they didn't want to. Now, she stirred up immediately venomous opposition. She was sent to prison. She was maltreated in all sorts of ways, but it made no difference to her at all. She just served her sentence, came out, and went on doing exactly the same things. Now, in the meantime, her mind was larger than one country. And in 1930, she took the responsibility of calling together in Zurich. Now, this is an event which isn't nearly enough recognized. An international conference of those individuals whom she could find in various countries who were taking an interest. And in 1930, I happened to be one of them, which was rather obvious because I was already a pioneer. And Blacker, you know him, my name?
I've heard the name,
Blacker,
yes.
He was invited, and various other women. It's a bit difficult to know their names.
Not to worry, one can find that sort
yes.
of thing out.
Let's go on for the history of the minute, then we'll think how we can get them later. So we arrived in Zurich. A curious kind of conference, quite a small one. I shouldn't think there were more than 30 to 40 people, representing, let us say, about five different, completely different nationalities. Who'd never met one another before, called together by Margaret Sanger's genius only, to discuss something that hardly existed.
An international movement?
No, there was no international movement. Ideas.
Even the idea, yes.
The ideas. There was no instrument then. There were faint beginnings, which we got to hear of there, in various countries. But faint beginnings was all you could say that they were. But it turned out that the people who were there and who talked about it and who aired the ideas and who, what is the word? It's not cultivated. What do you say to a plant when you started it?
Nurtured, nourished.
Inspired to do.
Yes, yes.
Inspired one another.
Mm-hmm.
the conference ended, we all went back to our own countries, and as far as anyone could see, nothing further happened until 1948. Now that's a very curious fact of history. 18 years. Now in those 18 years, the people who had been at that conference in their own countries were working quite individually and quite independently. There was no idea at all of joining them together. In the meantime, there came the European War. Now, the European War was a block.
Just because you can't make contact, you mean?
It was a physical block. You couldn't get out of your countries.
Yes.
But in the meantime, in the countries themselves, the work was going on.
Yes.
So if we make a jump to 1948, and also in the meantime, I come in as a curious personality because I am essentially international, and I got to know these people in Zurich and remember them, find out, keep on with a link as to what was happening in their various countries, looking for an opportunity, but not having any idea what would come. Now what did come was this, that the British movement in 1948 thought that they were strong enough to hold their first big conference. And this you can get all the papers of if you like. Now that was called for Cheltenham, and I think it was either June or July. Now immediately, quite silently, I saw my chance and thought of it that I was put in charge of the program. I was the chairman of the program, which of course in any conference is the key position.
It's like having the agenda in a committee, isn't it? Yes.
It's a key position. But it's a key position that has to be handled very tactfully, because you mustn't frighten the people around you, whose ideas are much smaller. So I proceeded with the utmost tact to do what I felt had to be done. Now quite early, that's perhaps the first or second meeting of the committee, I saw here was a chance of making a beginning of an international link. But nothing had to be said yet. It was far too difficult for merely the British people there to take in. So the program was planned. The theme of the thing was natural resources, something like life and natural resources. And I thought it said we had nothing but absolutely first-class speakers. And it'd be worth your while, from, if you haven't already seen it, from the headquarters to get the report of that conference. Because I interviewed most of those speakers, and I think my greatest catch, now here my memory's gone, that man in Cambridge who has such bad manners, but who was a China expert.
Oh, no.
I guess you know quite a lot. He has a small cap, and he has written a great deal.
Oh, not Needham.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Joseph Needham.
Did you really? Yes.
Joseph Needham. And I wrote to Joseph Needham, and never met him, but I knew about him, and said, I essentially want you to come and talk at this conference. He wrote back and said, what in the world do you want me to say? I said, come to lunch and I'll tell you. So he did, which was like him. Here was a totally strange woman, he didn't know what she wanted. But he had an instinct too. It was worthwhile finding out. So I had him to lunch, and we had an immediate link in China. Now, as you probably know, he is a first-class China expert of extreme brilliance. And what made a better link was, in talking, I managed to find out that the young Chinese student who went with him in his travels was the son of Burton, one of the greatest friends in
China. Oh, that started things off well then.
Yes, one of the home moderns. So he consented to give his talk and so on. And we won't go into the other details because you won't find them out. And I was watching the conference, of course, saying nothing to anybody until nearly the last 2 or 3 days. And then I began talking because we could and did invite 3 other nations, USA, Margaret Sanger, Sweden, Lisa Ossen-Jensen.
How do you spell that, just for the...
Ossen-Jensen,
yes.
O-T-T-E-S-E-N, hyphen,
Jensen.
J-E-N-S-E-N.
Thank you.
She was always called Otter, like the others. But I called her Lisa, because this is her name. And from Holland, now we've got to get his name. A doctor, a psychological doctor, Conrad, got it? Conrad van der Boas.
How do you spell Boas?
B-O-A-S.
Yes.
Now, he had been working there on what they definitely called the family planning movement. So I had my 4 countries, as it were, in embryo, and I began to talk to them separately. And to say, here we've got an unparalleled opportunity. I'm not going to let this conference disperse without our having created, we 4 leaders, and anyone you people want from your countries too, the embryo of an international framework. Well, they were immensely surprised. International is a very big idea. Only 4 countries here. I said something has to begin. If we can set up some kind of a skeleton, I'm absolutely certain it's going to grow. So at the end of the conference, we began to have long evening meetings. Bep Blacker immediately showed where he was going to be of unique importance because he had so much practice in putting words together for constitutions.
Drafting ability.
Drafting. And he was showing himself very quickly to have that capacity. And we immediately recognized it and said, well, Dr. Blacker, now then, you keep us in order. Some of us know what we want. We're 4 very different countries. We've got to try and find word formula which will be honestly supported by these 4 countries. And you haven't had any experience in international work yet,
no,
have you?
No.
So you haven't any idea how difficult it was. If you think of those 4 countries, their personalities were so different. The Dutch immediately showed this Conrad, their national characteristic. They had to disagree with everything when it was first suggested. Oh no, we can't have that. We must have something different. Then they had to learn patience. All right, Conrad, what do you suggest? Not very much. We had to go back and back and so on. So you have to put in your mind this piece of history. That evening after evening, I should think 3 or 4 evenings, 3 to 4 hours, we 4 countries' leaders beckoned to find words, and only to find words. We had the ideas, our minds were quite clear, but to find the words in English that would be acceptable to personalities of these 4 different countries was our first experience of how difficult that was. But we succeeded.
And what did you come out with?
We came out with a definite drafting constitution, which is there. It must be in all these 4 countries. Certainly in the IPPF, it didn't exist in office. And we called it an interim committee for international first of all, I think the word was still work.
Hmm.
And that had to, of course, to have a body, and it was decided that the office should be in London, because London is an easily acquired world centre.
Yeah, it's a good link between Europe and
And it had to have an address, and it had to have a secretary. Now, the first secretary, I've forgotten what her name was, but she wasn't good enough, because this was a very new, curious piece of work for anyone to do. And luckily, we found Vera Houghton.
I see.
Now that's where Vera begins.
I see, isn't it? Yeah.
And she was as inspired for this kind of work as Pip Blacker was for his rather mechanical part.
Mm.
So that when she became our first international secretary, things began to hum. But the origin of the world movement was Chelsea 48.
I see. Well, that's very clear.
Now, that you absolutely have to have as a foundation.
Mm.
Now, as soon as that was started, these four countries, each of them got a new pride in their own national work, because they could see it from four different points of view, and not only their own.
Mm.
And especially in Sweden, too. Lisa Ostenjensen was also a genius, and she was very, very much respected in her country. And as the machine was created, you say, so we found what kind of offices we had to have. And very soon we found we had to have someone who would go around to different countries, find out who the leaders were there, and be definitely missionaries.
And was that Lady Houghton?
And that is what happened, and Vera was one of the very best.
Mm.
Now you will find in the archives, in the IPPF, huge offices they've got now. Have you been there?
I haven't been there, no.
Well, you must go there. Mm. Now that is Lower Regent Street, I'll give you the address.
When did you get the name IPPF then? When did that come?
That was
later,
decided later on.
Yes.
At a next conference.
Yes.
We'll get to that.
Hmm.
Vera was sent round various countries. Now, France was an early country. In France, we made a mistake, we chose the wrong leader. But we had to deal with it. Germany was very difficult. Denmark was solid, slow, and we found the right leaders, Anita Bristrup and so on. You see these names.
Mm.
You have
why didn't them. You work with through the United Nations then? Why?
We are far too small.
I see.
Yes, now you see, now you've got to have, you keep your eye on that, because you can see, a piece of historic imagination. You are naturally talking from a present point of view.
Yes. Mm.
From the present point of view, where the principle of individual control has now been fought over and is a dead subject. It's allowed. Everybody agrees. But then, in 1948, to the next conference was 50, I think, you'll find that date.
Yes.
Well, we were regarded by most people as very odd indeed. What an extraordinary thing to want to do. What's the medical profession got to say? And we had to say, well, the medical profession's done. We're trying to lead them. And they're finding that they haven't got very much interest in the various countries. And this was different, of course. In some countries, the nascent movement was actually fought against and harassed in all sorts of ways.
Yes.
But we weren't going to many
particularly in Catholic
of that,
countries, I mean.
Because you can get whatever you want.
Yes.
Now, the next thing that happened was the next conference in Stockholm. which I think was 50, about 2 years later, when Pip Blacker, of course, was there, and all these people that you know, and the new names from the other countries, you'll have to get to learn.
Yes. Mm.
And our object there was to put the second stage into being, to draft a constitution which shouldn't be an interim, which should be final for the time being, and to call ourselves an international body with the idea of going to take in the rest of the world. Now there we labored. Again, it was exactly the same difficulty. Pip would suggest a beautiful English formula, as if you were a lawyer. The other people say, oh no, you can't have that word. That means something quite different in our language, and so on. But we stuck at it. And by the end of the conference, which is about a week, we got it. And you will find that this will be, should be interesting to you from your own academic point of view, how these various stages of the Constitution varied, and what made them vary, and what bigger functions they had.
Can I interrupt you now?
Please,
just one point, because you see,
it seems to me that you're showing the same sort of skills in the late 40s in relation to the international movement as you showed in the late 20s, early 30s in relation to the British movement. That is, you have to show a political sense. Where did you get this sense from?
It's very difficult to know. I think partly because I'm a hybrid.
I see, that's interesting, because it's particularly important for international work that you are,
yes,
isn't it?
Being half Polish, and of course we haven't had time to go into a personal childish history where we spent 3 or 4 months in the summer in Poland as, let's see, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, up to 12, on our own estates, with our own family members, of which there were 13 grandchildren belonging to my Polish grandmother, and I was the eldest. So we had practice.
What do you mean, running the other grandchildren?
Yes, the other grandchildren came to the center. And the center was my father's parents.
Would you like me to get you a drink of water? Would that be a
good
idea?
Yes, I think that would be good.
Because, I mean, you are...
Father was artist. And by that time, of course, you remember that we had freed ourselves in England from her.
Yes.
Now, you must have a little more of the world, and then we'll come back to what you like. So there we were, 1950. Now, you'll notice there's nothing of the Far East yet. Our viewpoint was Europe and America. Whole of Europe, but no further. Now, in the meantime, in India, a very great friend of mine, Mrs. Reena Dutta, who married a prominent Christian Indian, I sent her out. When she went there, I said, now, you've got to start. Here's an enormous country. Begin talking about birth control. Never mind what they say, never mind if they won't listen to you. But sow the seed as wide as you can. They belonged to the Indian and the world YMCA, so they had a certain amount of position and respect. And that was very good work. Now that had fruition. Now we come to 1952. Very important year. Now, in 1952, the leaders of the Indian movement had woken up, had planned their own movement with the full help and, what can we say, cooperation is not too strong, of Nehru, which made all the difference in the world, and the then Prime Minister. And their leader was Lady Rama Rao, who you see is a very prominent figure. And she said, we are going to have an international conference in Bombay. we're going to carry on from Stockholm. We are going to belong to the international body, and we're going to push it further.
Could I just interrupt you and ask you, is there any connection between all this and the International Women's Suffrage Alliance?
None at all. Now, that's what is difficult for you to take in.
Mm.
The two lines of fundamental sympathy have points in common.
Yes, but they're not integrally linked.
Their roots are quite different.
Yes.
The roots of our lot were freedom for the individual and salvation from physical misery.
Yes. It's a sort of extension.
Very medical, at root medical, and very humanitarian.
Yes.
But apolitical. It had no politics at all.
Mm.
At that stage, there was no reason why it should, because politics wouldn't help us.
Mm.
Now, in 1952, for this first conference, I was invited. Now, by that time, 48 to 52, you see, there have been 4 years in which things have been quietly growing, and I've been thinking. And I didn't know these people at all, but I wrote to the heads and said, yes, I will come if somebody will pay the fare. See, here's another point. In all this movement, nobody was paid. All the pioneers gave their own time without the faintest thought of payment. And unfortunately, that being a difficulty now in the next generation. So somebody had to find the money for the fares, but personal payment there was none. And I wrote and I said, yes, I will come. Now, if you like, I'll do two more things. After the conference is over, I will begin to teach your Indian women doctors the techniques of birth control, which they haven't got yet. And after that, I will spend the next, I don't know how many weeks it was, alone, going across North India, talking in any places come which was fresh, but one fundamental condition, which was that I met no white people.
You couldn't speak the language there, could you?
No, I couldn't speak any language. But everyone talks English in India.
I see, yes.
You see, 52 was very soon after the freedom.
Sort of lingua franca, in a way, yes.
So they thought this was a bit odd for a Brit. But they said, well, here's an odd person coming. We'll allow it. And that's what they did. And I had marvellous time. First, the conference itself was a resounding success. We did a little more tinkering to the constitution. That happened at nearly all the international conferences. Because as the whole field got wider, you had to bring in more different circumstances. And Nehru was very good for us. And we had an enormous audience. And this was the first time anything sort of happened in India. It was in Bombay, in the biggest hall.
Is it, I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong, but is it the case that you, in underdeveloped countries, as we now call them, you have first of all to deal with the problem of health, that is, the sort of things you were dealing with in China in the 1920s, that is, dealing with disease.
No, you go straight away for gynecology.
I see.
You go straight away for midwifery. If you start there, well, you'd never get there.
No, what my point is this. You see, you only need they only realise the need for birth control when the health problem's been dealt with. Do you see what I mean?
No, but you're wrong. It wasn't that way around.
Yes.
That's far too logical.
Mm.
And our field were miserable women. Married women, same field, who already had too many children, most of whom had died. And they made an immediate public, because any married woman wants her children to live. There's no opposition there at all.
Mm.
And the rest of the machinery, we had to invent as we went along. Now, I saw and taught them that the indispensable groundwork were trained women doctors. Without trained women doctors, the movement couldn't exist. Because you have to remember all the time that the people we were working with were mothers, pregnant women. Because in India there are no pregnant unmarried women. There, the system was quite simple. And in order for that to be done, somebody has to go there to tell them what to do.
So and you're doing again the same as you did in England.
Yes, and that was my job.
Yes.
So now you will have to have a little detail because it was so dramatic. These people, of course, didn't know what I wanted at all. I said, well, I must have some kind of private space. All right. So they put up a small wooden shack, you would never guess where, in the corner of the station yard of the biggest railway station. And it had only one room, but it did have some water, and I told them what they wanted in the way of a table and so on. And I said, right, I will be here for a week, and I'll teach every day. Of course they were delighted. And you won't be able to guess what the difficulty was. The difficulty was models. On whom was I going to teach? I hadn't invented my own model then. And they found a nurse, excellent nurse. She was born for the job. And there we were, immediately after the conference, struggling with only one model. But I managed to teach 30 women. Which wasn't bad, because that was the beginning. Mm. And then I started off on my travels. They were very dramatic, a bit too much to go into in detail. Going across India until I arrived in Calcutta. In Calcutta, there was more, which was a great surprise. There was a series, no, it was I think a society, Mawari, have you ever heard of the
No,
name?
No, I'm not.
It was made of rich business people who also had a humanitarian interest. And the head of it was a Mr. B.M. Singhi. And I was put in his charge. He was my bear leader. And what happened all the time was, of course, I had to stay with people. And they chose my hostesses very wisely in every place. When I got to Calcutta, I was billeted with some people called Chowdhury, and Mr. Chowdhury was a barrister, a very prominent, busy barrister, and his wife, Sita, well, she received this strange white creature into her house, and we instantly became friends. So I already had two Indian families, one in Bombay, Lady Rama Rao, and one in Calcutta, the Chowdhurys. And that is now, what, 27 years ago.
And that got it launched
in India.
I've
just come back from it, still. Mm. Now, in Calcutta, Mr. Singhi had a very wide program. He made me go to all sorts of places, all sorts of different social circles to start things.
Upper-class circles, presumably, is
upper-class and lower class.
I see.
And law students.
I see.
He had a very wide view. And that was the beginning of the work there. Now we've got to 52. Now we can make jumps, because you must have
overall
a consciousness that something powerful had taken place, and something that couldn't be stopped. Now, between 1952, the next conference was in Tokyo, which was 53 or 54. Now, that was another landmark, Japan, completely different country. Now, when we got to Japan, we sent Vera. Vera always had to go on ahead. Oh, yes, you must have two little bits. Vera was sent on ahead to Bombay. Because it was almost an axiom that any country starting a new international conference wouldn't have an idea what to do. So she went about 3 weeks before the date of the conference and found that they had a very big committee room in Greens. Do you know India at all?
No.
In Bombay?
Japan, no.
No, we're in Bombay. Oh, yes, yeah, so we've gone back with you.
Yeah.
Next to the Taj Hotel. A huge room with lots of people around working. And Vienna came in. They, of course, knew that she'd been sent from the international, not from England, just happened to be English. And she went around talking to these people and found these charming girls in their adorable saris, having no idea of any kind of organisation at all. So she began to say, well, what are you doing? What are you doing? And they all said the same answer. You see, Mrs. Houghton, we're all doing a little bit of everything. And that is our famous international phrase. Which showed Vera, of course, at once that unless she got to it, there couldn't be a conference. Mm. So she had to work that in. Well, that was the experience. Now, next we have Japan. We sent Vera to Japan. And, of course, we were in intimate touch with her all the time. At least I was, because I was far more international then, although I had all the jobs to do in England.
Yes.
But by 52 we were swinging along. We'd done most of the
Real growth period is in the 50s, isn't it?
Most of the fundamental thinking.
Yes.
Mm. And the thing was, had gained enough momentum to run almost by itself. So I didn't feel that I was neglecting them at all, giving all this attention to the foreigners. Now, she went to Japan, and there was a man, the top man, doctor, something like Kyoto, well, a simple name. And Vera wrote back to me and said, I'm getting along very well in Japan because I realize what to do. The bear leader, this professor, if I go with him out, if I walk just 4 paces behind him all the time, then everything is all well. And that, for Vera to realize and to trot along always behind the man, instead of being the fons et arrivo, which she was, but she succeeded. Now, that conference, again, was a terrific success. The Japanese showed that they seemed to have a natural genius for organization. It was very well done, partly in Japanese and partly in English. Here we were beginning with our ever-present trouble of interpretation. We had only 2 languages at that time. And the Japanese people were so overcrowded anyway that this message was very welcome. And we had a large English delegate, and we stayed at the Imperial Hotel, a very famous hotel, and so on, and that was a great success. And so, now I don't think you need any more details.
That's marvellous. So in fact, the international movement takes off in the 1950s,
yes,
really.
Yes. Mm. The international movement grew and grew and grew. Conferences, which you could find out from the IPPF office, which you should, took place from time to time, always very carefully chosen in a key place.
With the idea to spread it in that
place.
With
the idea that the whole world was our field.
Mm.
That was the first simple idea. Now we begin with the next one, which would be more what you're looking for. What was to be our relationship with the governments of all these countries and with their laws? Because very soon the question of abortion began to come up.
Could I just ask you, before you start on that, what was your attitude in the 1930s to the British government?
Very simple. Do you remember that beautiful story from Margaret Pike and Eva.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, it's really to get the government organised.
Yes,
I mean,
teach them.
Yes, I mean, you want to abandon your activities to the government, don't you?
Well,
that
was going too far. Mm. We wanted them to understand what we were doing, and gradually for them to realise that ultimately this was their responsibility. But the word ultimately turned out to be 45 years.
Yes, I understand.
45 years in which we were working all the time. Now, how this is a sensible question, because I can answer it. How did we work it? Like this. And now we're talking about England. Simply England.
Yes. Mm.
That as the movement grew in England, a different set of people were appointed, a sort of travelling secretaries who were sent around the country in regions to hopeful looking places, and their duty always was first to go to the MOH in his official house, the Minister of Health, and to say, we intend opening a family planning clinic in your town. We invite you to have it on your premises. But of course, the MOHs were staggered. Someone should come with the idea so completely thought out. And we had every possible kind of adventure. From complete success, where it happened, the MOH was a forward-looking person who already had read something about it and who was interested and said, yes, yes, we can link it on. We can link it on to our already running clinics. But here the pioneer person said, we will not use your doctors. This is going back to my first principle. This is a specialist affair. We are bringing in our own doctor who is specially trained, and our own nurses who are specially trained. So as the years went by in England, very gradually, more and more of the machinery of the Ministry of Health became involved. Now, I told you it was a beautiful story what happened in Kensington when we made
yes,
our...
Yes, when you went to the town hall,
well,
yes.
That was the kind of thing that was happening up and down the country.
So there's no antagonism to government as such at all.
Well,
it's
the government
really
isn't yet involved. This is the Ministry of Health.
Yes.
The government was too far off and far too indifferent to be approached as yet.
Or nervous even, I suppose.
We weren't strong enough.
Mm.
But very gradually, some of the MOHs were unusual people and they would have friends in the government. And we always had the idea that ultimately nothing but the government will do. But it was very, very slow. And I can't tell you much of the stages of that because I...
No, that's interesting. That involved. Answers my question. But when you get back to the international movement, then you don't have that problem. You work from the top down,
yes.
Don't you?
Well, now, in the international movement, it's very difficult to say because no two countries are alike.
No. Mm.
And with the ones who were Roman Catholics, say, well, now I can give you perhaps one country where it was very typical, Poland. And you can take this as a type. Now, this was 57. We had had a conference in Berlin because the German movement was very sticky. But it happened one day that they arrived at my clinic at Telford Road, a Polish doctor, woman doctor, to be taught. Now, by that time, I had got a very keen nose for the people who were going to be really good. And immediately, this was an outstanding person, very beautiful to begin with, couldn't talk any English, so we did everything in German, but her hands were so skillful that I only had to teach her the new movements.
Mm.
She was absolutely ideal. And she came for 3 times. I taught her completely. Now, at the end of the 3rd session, she began to take initiative. She said, when everything is gone, this is all in German, I want to talk to you, Dr. Wright. I said, all right, come on. And we had the same little table as we had before. She sat there, so, and I said this side. And she looked me straight in the eye and she said, you've got to come to Poland. You have to come to Poland, you have to teach us, you have to start a family planning movement in Poland. It's very difficult to startle me, but I was rather startled. Because she was the only person who had come from Poland at all. So we sat and thought, and I said, all right, now we'll think of the fundamentals here and now. 1, I will only go if I get an official invitation from your government and my foreign office approves. That's absolutely essential. 2, I offer you a fortnight, 14 days. I demand a minimum of 4 different universities. In those 4 different universities, you will find me an interpreter, and we will have as our audience doctors, medical students, and nurses who will listen to all the same fundamental preliminary lecture. And then I looked at her and smiled, and I said, you don't know how well you've chosen, because I'm half Polish. Her eyes jumped out. She said, isn't that extraordinary? Because it happened that I was the very first lecturer from the West that had come to Poland at all. So half the battle was done with the introduction.
But you see, your procedure is entirely different from what it could have been in England in the 1930s, isn't it? I mean, you work through the government straight away.
You see, that's where I'm useful. Yes. My mind is so flexible that every country has to be considered as a problem entirely in itself. And it's only when you've got your movement rooted and working there that you can begin to talk internationally to them.
So really, if you look at the history of the international movement, England is a sort of, well, England, America, Holland, and one or two other countries are sort of training grounds for a world experiment in a way, aren't they? I mean,
because we had personalities such as I was, but we haven't quite finished. We must get the picture just a little more in focus. What was the problem? Now, the problem there was twofold, and it looked as if both were impossible. The government was communist. The whole country was Roman Catholic.
Yes.
I had to find a way of teaching that would be welcomed by both. And I did.
I don't know how you could have done it.
Well, if you're interested, I will tell you. Because if I hadn't thought that out, it would have been a total failure.
Because, you see, my preconception is that the communists would oppose birth control because they would say that the best way to cure poverty is through socialist measures. And the Catholics would say, well, we can't have birth control.
We can't have anything at all because we're wicked. You're all going to hell.
So how on earth did you manage it?
Well, I managed it like this. Now, first, faith was very useful. What was it called? Woman and Health, something like that, had a woman minister, and she was another picked person. Now, she and I took to one another instantly, and she realized what the difficulties were. And I said, now, we're not going to talk politics at all. Just wait till the end of the fortnight. All I ask you to do for the moment is supply the facilities. Make the arrangements in these 4 universities from the top so that everybody knows that the government approves. That was the first thing that was essential. Or they couldn't come. Now, with the Roman Catholics, the priests, what could be done there? Now I thought out a very cunning scheme. You must have heard, there's a Roman Catholic, the chap in Germany, in the Okino Klaus, and in Japan, had been working on fertility effects of women's ovulation history. And they'd had the very simple idea that no matter how often intercourse happens, there's only one egg a month. That egg has a short life. If, therefore, the days during which, it is exaggerated, that egg is present, are completely avoided, you have a method of controlling conception.
I see.
Of which we entirely approve. Well, we talked this out in the conference before in Berlin, and we had Klaus there, and we told him what nonsense this was. All sorts of reasons, which we needn't go into. But it was a method. Physiologically, you couldn't say that wasn't completely true. So, in my lectures, when I was talking about methods, I said, now, the method we begin with, and in your country, this is my advice, every clinic that you start offers every Roman Catholic patient the rhythm method.
Yes.
And says nothing about any other method. In the meantime, I'm teaching you doctors that that method's not going to work, but we're going to keep quiet about that. These new patients, when they come, they will find their own atmosphere. You can even have a priest at the clinic, if you like. They did that in Portugal.
Did they really?
They had a priest at the clinic. And they will be told all about the rhythm method, honestly, completely, fully, as far as it's possible to go. And then they'd be left alone. And then I would say to the audience, because the audience will be very bewildered by that, what's going to happen next? These women will go back, they will do their best with the rhythm method, they will find it doesn't work. After they've each had about three more unwanted children, now listen, they themselves will come back to the clinic and say, I'm a Roman Catholic, but I want something different. So I had the whole church on my side.
That's pretty good.
Was that cunning?
But where, can we just get back to where you get this cunning from? I mean, you said you went with your fellow grandchildren. In Poland.
Of course. Well, in Poland, yes. And you were quite clearly. But you must care.
I mean, it seems to be terribly
important. Now, just a minute. I'm now talking to the mic. Yes. We've stopped talking about anything international. We're now purely family.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Because there's no connection between the two.
No.
Now, we go back. My father was Polish. My mother was English. My father came from a family of four boys, of which he was a third. His father and mother lived in a small town, not even a town, in a small village called Kronov, where they were the only important family.
How do you spell that?
C-H-R-Z-A-N-O-W. Kronov. And what it means is rather amusing. Kron is the Polish for horseradish. And the name of the village means the place where horseradish grows wild. That's just a historic fact.
Okay, yes, yes.
Now, in the village of Kron, we had a very large estate, square miles and miles of forest and lake, and everything of that sort, and a very powerful grandmother. She was an extraordinary character. I'm certain that she was Jewish, but she became Roman Catholic. Now, again, it's very odd how these double notes occur in this history. She ruled the village, but she ruled the village partly because she had joined the Roman Catholic Church, but really because of her personality. And the four brothers were as different as they could possibly be. We'll just do them very quickly. The eldest was called Willie. He chose to go to Berlin to become a lawyer, where he did very well, and he was a judge in one of the law courts. Second one was called Adolf. He was very tall with red hair, and he was a little dotty, and he was mad on words, an entomologist. Therefore, he was a teacher in a school. Third, my father, Henry, who at that time had no characteristics. Fourth, Bruno, who was the best looking and the only rather foolish one. He looked after his own property. And things went on. No. My father said to his father one day, I'm not going to stay here. I've had the ordinary, this was Austrian Poland, in the corner there, the ordinary education, it's no good. There's no future for a young man here on a landed estate. You give me £5, I'm going to London. Father said, my poor chap, you're dotty. You know, can't talk English. What's he going to do in London? He said, I don't know, but I'm going. Now it happened, he did know one person, and that was my mother's father.
Who was your mother's father?
No, we don't put that in. Now you've got a bit of Poland.
Yes, yes.
Now we have something quite different. Now in Tulthill, or Clapham, I'm not quite sure which, there was a very English family called Evans, E-V-E-N-S. And I've got all the details of this. This is all perfectly historic. Now in the family of Evans, there were five girls. In the family of the Löwenfels, there were four boys. At the moment, there was no link.
Löwenfels is your father?
Yes.
Yes.
No link between them at all. But it happened that the fourth girl, who was called Alice, was anemic, thin, rather weakly. Her parents were worried about her. Now it also happened that they had a friend, a doctor, his name is gone, we'll come back in a minute, who was Polish and who was a scholar and who was attached to the British Museum. And he went to tea one day with the mother of Alice, and the mother talked him all about her worries. So he thought for a moment, and he said, this pregnant sentence, why don't you send your daughter to Poland to my sister for 6 months to set up her health? She was then 17. Now my grandparents must have been extraordinarily unworldly. What they did, the others also doesn't matter with this story. He said, well, that's a good idea. And they sent this child alone. Imagine what the trains were like in Europe then. From Tulthill or Clapham, wherever they were, to this tiny village in Poland with a family of four boys. Four continental boys. Of course they thought, here's a marvellous opportunity. All four tried to seduce her. The only idea of a young continental male having a 17, defenceless 17-year-old English girl sent into the house for 6 months. They all failed. But the English girl fell in love with the third son.
That's Henry.
Henry. And fell in love for life. She had, I don't know what capacity, to realize that there was a genius. That here was this very remarkable family, but it contained one genius. And the genius was the third son, called Henry. Now, how much was overt between them? During that visit, nobody knows. She came back, and he followed. And her father was the only person he knew in England. So this young fellow, age 25, no experience at all, £5 in his pocket, arrived in London. And very soon he discovered what he could do, and that was to make money. He found there was no difficulty whatever in making money. The only thing you had to do was to know what to use. And that was the essence of his genius. And his first profit was his Swiss cuckoo clocks. His mind was huge. There's no snobbishness anywhere in this whole story. And he very, very quickly found that there was no difficulty in making money. The difficulty was different. After having succeeded in one enterprise, he got bored with it, and he had to sell it. And of course, he knew my mother, and he was very fond of her. And they married in 1884. In 1884, they lived in Brixton. I was born in Brixton in 1887. And he was working in various small things. And then one day he hired a pony cart or phaeton or something, and he took his wife up to the West End. And he drove her round Lowndes Square. And he said, "This is where we're going to live." And she looked at him, thinking something had gone wrong with him.
From very expensive area. Mm.
Straight away. And now that's exactly what happened. Now, he was Polish. He therefore knew the Polish embassy. Now, the Polish embassy had two houses on the southeast corner of Lowndes Square, which had a long lease. And he went to the embassy and said, "I want to buy the lease of this house. You can get another one." They were very pleased because they really wanted to do that, but they had failed to find a purchaser because the house was infected by bugs. And apropos, bugs are a family pet. All Polish villages have bugs. The idea that you don't take a house because there's bugs
was so... And you wouldn't take a house at all.
Was so absurd. That's why my father got the lease, the head lease, of the beautiful place, two houses into one, for very little, and very soon got rid of the bugs. So in 1890, this little family, father, one daughter, moved.
Is that you?
Yes.
Yes.
From Brixton to 31 Lowndes Square. And there, in 1890, my sister was born in February. And she's turned out to be another genius. But we can't go to her because it's nothing to do with the story. Now, we have to remember, my father was Polish. He was very keenly Polish. In spite of his successes in England, he would never change. He refused a title, he refused a seat in Parliament. He said, "No, I'm Polish. I belong to Poland." And he adored his mother. Now, in the meantime, his mother was getting into financial difficulties. You can't run an estate like that. You can't make anything at all. So he came to her rescue and bought the estate for her. Now, that meant that his family, this little family of two girls, had two homes, one in Poland and one in London. And we used to go over to Poland for the summer, for 3 months or so, about every other year. In the meantime, the other brothers had all married. And as soon as the place in Charnoff was sound and was run properly, they all came there too. And that's how my sister and I began with an international experience.
But did you admire your grandmother?
Yes.
Was she an important influence?
A very important influence. And I've got one letter from her. She is a remarkable woman who talked English very well. And as I was the oldest grandchild, well, as a small child, you don't get much impression of personality, but she was the sort of person you couldn't fail to notice. So we had the great luck to be internationally trained.
Because you remember how we started on this. It was, I was asking you about how you got this political sense that you obviously got, and which
none
is so important.
Not political sense, international sense.
Yes.
I won't have the word politics.
Well, by political, you mean, what I mean is, how you, and a sense of how you get things done. Do you see what
yes.
I mean?
Yes, well, I call that international. Mm. Because we had, Germans, Poles, English, three nationalities.
But you see, you've got this ability even when you're in England. You're dealing just with the English movement.
Yes.
I mean, you've got this ability to know how to make things work. Do you know what I mean?
It's very difficult to know how much was congenital. Because our father was very definitely a very unusual genius.
Because Eva's a bit like that. Eva Hubbock's a bit that as well, isn't it? And that's one of the things you have in common, isn't it?
It was a Jewish background.
Well, that, and this ability to manage things. Do you know what I mean?
And to manage things without annoying anybody.
Yes.
To take on jobs the others didn't want.
Can you just tell me briefly your education?
Yes. Now, because of that, you've got that.
Yes, that's fine, yes.
Now then, we have a different setting. Lowndes Square, 31 Lowndes Square, a huge double house with a staff of servants, very wealthy, very dull, two girls, no cousins, because the others, my mother's sisters were very odd, they all married foreigners. So we had no English cousins at all, our cousins were all in Poland. And we started at Madame Michaelis. She came to London with the first kindergarten. What did you call it? Effort? Little school, Hempstead. So we went there and enjoyed that very much, both of us. Then we went to a perfectly ordinary school in Queensgate. Well, nothing much happened.
Kensington, that is. South Kensington, isn't it? Queensgate.
Yes, South Kensington. Going up to the park.
Yes, I know, yes.
An ordinary school. Then my mother thought it was time me, the elder, had something a bit wider. So she took me to Princess Helena College, Ealing, as a boarder. Now, I have written it down somewhere, but I haven't got time to tell you. The extraordinary effect of a hybrid from this very odd family. So rich.